This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. It costs millions of dollars for a pharmaceutical company to produce a new drug or medical treatment. First, the drug has to be developed, then it has to go through rigorous testing on animals and eventually humans in order to make it through the licensing and approval phase. But only nearly 90% of medications don't make it all the way through the process to become something your doctor can then write you a prescription for. And a lot of the research about why a drug might have failed, what it interacted with, what its side effects are, never gets published or released to the public or other researchers. Our guest today says that's problematic. He'd like to see more of the research on stalled drug trials made public, and he says it would help lower the astronomical cost of drug trials and the resulting medications and make people safer and improve the ethics of trials moving forward. But pharmaceutical companies are mostly privately held and mostly for-profit companies, so why would they release proprietary information that could benefit other companies doing similar research? I'm joined now by Jonathan Kimmelman, Associate Professor of Biomedical Ethics at McGill University in Montreal. He's our guest today to talk about the research he does on the risk-benefit balance in the testing and regulating of new pharmaceuticals. Professor Kimmelman, welcome to Vermont Edition and happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks for having me.
So why is it that only 11 out of every 100 drugs that are researched and started through that development process ever make it to market?
There are a number of reasons. The Food and Drug Administration has very stringent standards of safety and efficacy that need to be demonstrated for a new drug. And it can be very difficult to meet that standard. Oftentimes, a drug that looks very promising in animals, once you test it in human beings, that promise evaporates. And that partly reflects that animal models are very different than human systems. Another reason why so many drugs fail in clinical development is that the signals that you pick up in some clinical trials are often not good representations of what you're trying to pick up when you use a drug in clinical practice.
So, what do you mean by that?
Well, typically, in order to get a drug licensed, you have to go through three different phases of clinical testing: phase one, phase two, and phase three. In phase two testing, you're typically trying to detect efficacy using what scientists call a surrogate marker, something that gives you a fairly quick and dirty picture of whether a drug is going to be useful in clinical practice. Those surrogate markers often are imperfect representations of the kinds of clinical endpoints or the clinical responses that people actually care about in a clinical setting. So oftentimes you may get a lot of signal in a phase two trial on a surrogate marker, but then once you put that to a rigorous clinical trial in patients, you find that that signal evaporates.
So do you just mean that what actually happens in my human body in response to that drug may be different than what the testing models would suggest? Is that an accurate
interpretation? Yeah. So for example, in cancer, typically a phase two trial will use tumor shrinkage as a way to detect whether or not a cancer drug is active. Patients generally don't care so much whether their tumors shrink. What they care about is whether they'll survive longer with their cancer. And so in a phase three clinical trial, rather than using tumor shrinkage, you'll typically use survival. So you might get really whopping signal for tumor shrinkage in a phase two trial. But then once you put it to phase three, you actually see that although you still get good tumor shrinkage, you actually don't get much survival advantage.
Okay, got it. So when we look at this and say, you know, one out of every 10 drugs basically makes it to market, that could be seen in a number of ways depending on how you contextualize it. Either, wow, that is a whopping 90% of drugs that are going through the testing process that don't make it, and that's a real shame and a problem, or we've dodged a bullet because we now know that these drugs that were being marketed wouldn't necessarily work or be safe, and so it's a good thing that there's that testing process. Or even you could think 10%, that's pretty good given how difficult it is to treat illnesses. So where do you come down?
Yes to all of the above. Very insightful observation there. So on the one hand, there's no doubt that there are many inefficiencies in the way we develop drugs. Lots of drugs should never have been put to phase one or phase two clinical trials, or they should have been stopped before they've gotten to phase three. So some of the waste that we have is due to bad decision making. On the other hand, we can see the silver lining in the failure in that drug regulators are stopping unsafe and ineffective drugs from getting out there to the market. And your third point is also a valid one, which is that this is really difficult science. It's much harder to develop a drug than to develop a new semiconductor or a new microprocessor. Biological systems are incredibly complex. You might have a drug that seems to modulate a disease course, but that's toxic, or the other way around, a drug that seems perfectly safe, but it doesn't really have an impact on disease. So it's really, really tough science to go from a biological concept in the laboratory to something that's clinically useful.
We're talking today about what goes into taking a drug from concept all the way through to market and why only 11 out of every 100 drugs actually gets there. My guest is McGill bioethicist Jonathan Kimmelman. He studies the risk-benefit balance in the testing and regulating of new pharmaceuticals. And we'd love to hear from you. Do you have a question about this? Do you have a deep understanding of how drug R&D works? Do you think it's inefficient? Do you think there could be better ways to do this process? Maybe you work for a pharmaceutical company. What's your perspective from inside the business? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Professor Kimmelman, you say there are inefficiencies in this process and that they can lead to wasteful spending, duplicate research, sometimes harmful testing. Why do you say it's an inefficient process rather than the one that's just sort of arduous and difficult, and that kind of failure rate and that risk is acceptable because that's necessary to get these drugs to market?
Right. So it's hard to know exactly where the optimal point is. So obviously the science is really difficult. We can't be successful all the time. Drug regulators need to have high standards. But clearly we could be doing science better in drug development. And one of the major inefficiencies we have in drug development is that most of the information, most of the scientific knowledge that we're generating when we develop drugs never actually gets out there into the public domain. And that means that other drug developers, other scientists, for that matter, policymakers, can't build off of that information to sharpen their tools for developing new drugs.
And why do you think that information should be released? I mean, obviously, it would enhance that ability for other people, other companies, governments to do that regulation. But isn't that information that's sort of proprietary to the company that's actually doing the research?
Well, that's certainly how the companies see it. A big reason why that information ought to be released is that every time you test a new drug, you are exposing patients to a potentially unsafe and ineffective drug. You're inconveniencing patients. The patients may be exposed to research procedures. So there's some sacrifice that patients are making to generate this knowledge. When drug companies don't make this information public knowledge, when it can't be absorbed into the body of scientific evidence, it means that that sacrifice that patients are making goes unredeemed. So I think it's a really fundamental ethical tenet that if you are doing a human experiment, that information ought to go out there into the public domain so that others can build off of the knowledge that you've produced.
So who should compel that information being released?
Well, I think there are a number of different actors that have some responsibility here, starting with the Food and Drug Administration. They actually could, in principle, have the authority to require that drug developers release this information. I think academic medical centers could make it a condition of hosting a clinical trial that there will be an expectation that the sponsor will publish the results of that clinical trial once it's complete. I think clinical researchers who are running these trials, who are putting their names on the protocols, ought not to put their names on protocols unless they are very confident that these trials are going to be published. And finally, every time a clinical trial is run, ethics review boards, there are these committees that review the risk-benefit and the informed consent for a clinical trial. They, too, ought not to approve a clinical trial unless there is a credible plan for publication of the results.
And have you gotten any responses? You published a paper that you were a lead researcher on that said just about that. Have you gotten responses from those constituencies saying yay or nay?
Well, certainly the proponents of making more information available have gotten lots of positive feedback, and that's encouraging. But it's pretty easy to be ignored by the opponents. So not a huge amount of response. But I think that there is the very first kinds of discussions around transparency and clinical trial data began in the late 1980s, and there has been a crescendo of demands placed on pharmaceutical companies to increase transparency. It's taken a long time to make progress, but I think we've made a lot of progress. We still have a lot farther to go, but I see this as being a campaign that is likely ultimately to be successful. So, years to go to finally get to the goalpost of complete trial transparency, but we've gotten a lot farther over the last 5 or 10 years.
And you're only really asking for pharmaceutical companies to be compelled to release that data, or to release that data once a drug has already gotten all the way to a human trial, not on animal trials, not on research that's been done where it doesn't even reach the human trial phase.
Well, I would actually go further back into the animal stages as well. But first things first, I think that there's a much more compelling ethical reason why one ought to require publication and transparency on clinical trials. But I actually think that there's a huge – there's a lot of information that is lost in clinical trialing due to non-publication of results. There's a huge amount of information that's lost in animal research. We just see the tip of the iceberg in the medical literature, and I think that too has to change. That struggle is probably a decade behind the struggle for clinical trial transparency, but ultimately I think that's the direction we want to go.
But again, these are private companies that are putting their own money forward to do this research, and certainly, and we'll get into it in a little while later, that research cost gets passed along to consumers and to insurance companies in the end. But nonetheless, these are private companies. They are doing the research. They are putting forward the money to get these drugs all the way to trial. Why should they release information that then some other company is going to take without having done any of that research and be able to develop a new drug based on somebody else's cost and research?
Sure. So absolutely, these are privately funded initiatives. It's very expensive to develop a new drug. But that expenditure of resources does not license drug companies to act in an unethical way. So if they have exposed patients to a new drug, particularly if that new drug turns out to be unsafe and or ineffective, they have an ethical obligation to make that information part of the public record so that science can advance. And so even if they have underwritten the cost of that development, they still have ethical obligations to redeem the sacrifice that patients have made. I'll mention really quickly that I think I take very seriously the need to enable companies to make a profit from developing their drugs. It's a very costly process to develop a new drug. But I think that's really – there are various ways to, on the one hand, protect their proprietary interest while, on the other hand, honoring the sacrifice of patients. So, for example, you can have an embargo period. You can say that you will allow companies to withhold publication of those results for a year or a year and a half, but that after a year or a year and a half, there's an expectation that the results are going to be published. And that gives the companies a little bit of protection. The other point to make is that if you level the playing field, if you make it so that all the companies have to release that information, you are eliminating any kind of competitive advantage that any one company is going to, or disadvantage that any one company is going to have if they make the information public and the other ones don't.
Do you have any examples? I mean, given the lack of transparency, I can see where this would be difficult to point to exactly. But do you have examples of where you see this being a problem, where humans have been tested on something that research might already have shown to be ineffective or dangerous?
Well, typically when drugs are developed, developed to target a particular mechanism in the human body. And so many drug companies might be developing a drug that targets that exact same mechanism. So pretty much any drug, if there are, or any drug is part of a class that many other drug companies may be developing drugs for. So if you get information about the safety or the efficacy of targeting that mechanism, other developers of drugs who are pursuing the same mechanism are going to want to have information that's going to allow them to improve the design of their clinical trials. So, you know, I think this is, you know, the point is a very general point, which is that if you're developing a new drug, you want to get as much information as you can about the mechanisms so that you can anticipate safety and efficacy issues for developing other drugs that are chemically related.
But it sounds like that idea of a specific example you don't have because you don't have the data? I mean, there's no patient who says, I was involved in this clinical trial. I later found out that other researchers already knew that this carried a really high risk.
Mm-hmm. It's really hard to have a smoking gun in drug development where you can really sort of pinpoint that had the information about this different drug been available to researchers, they might have been able to prevent a particular death, or they might have been able to forestall, you know, a clinical trial. It wouldn't be hard to find examples of lots of, you know, drug trials that probably a credible observer would be able to argue that they shouldn't have been pursued. But I think it's tough to find a smoking gun there.
We're talking today with Jonathan Kimmelman. He's a McGill University professor and a biomedical ethicist. And we're looking at how drugs go from concept to trial to market and why he thinks there's some glaring problems with the current model. We've talked a little bit about how drug trials work. Coming up, we're going to investigate why they cost so much and why the resulting medications cost so much, how a different model might actually affect drug costs. We're going to look as well at how different countries approach this process. And if you have a question or you're involved in this and you want to share your perspective, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today I'm talking with Jonathan Kimmelman, Associate Professor of Biomedical Ethics at McGill University in Montreal. Professor Kimmelman has been telling us about some of the risks involved in testing new medications on humans and animals and how he thinks the process should be more transparent. We're also going to talk about the massive expense involved and why different guidelines for sharing research might help decrease some of those costs. Although, again, difficult to figure out how you compel private companies to give up proprietary data and possible money. If you have a question about the science and the ethics involved in medical testing, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also carry on the conversation on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And let's go to Gerald, who's calling in from Montreal. Hi, Gerald. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm a medical oncologist and a cancer center director at one of the McGill hospitals up here in Montreal as well. But I'm also part of a group of American and Canadian drug development academics in the cancer context who have been making a completely different argument here about obstructions and delays in developing new treatments for cancer patients. And that is that over the years, regulators have added layers and layers and layers of absolutely unnecessary tasks, which are costly, take time, cost money, which of course is passed on to consumers ultimately into the healthcare system. And we're in the process of now publishing one paper, accepted another, being reviewed. Critical evaluations of each of the steps, including all the preclinical toxicity in animals, where tests are done in animals, demonstrating that there's been very few examples of anything learned in those very expensive and time-consuming studies that are of any benefit, either for protecting patients or for ensuring that the drugs are ultimately effective. And in fact, we can now start to calculate, and we have done a model based on 21 drugs approved in the last 5 years by the FDA and, of course, by Health Canada. We can calculate the number of lifetimes lost due to delays in the approval of a drug that ultimately proved to be of some benefit. So we're in fact losing more lives than we're gaining in the process for totally unnecessary reasons. So while it's important to be transparent about information, the proliferation of useless, unnecessary information, which is then passed along in the cost and the time delays to the patient, is really, I think, at the heart of the matter.
Gerald, yeah, thanks for your call. I appreciate that perspective. Professor Kimmelman, where do you come down on that? Because I can see the idea that sharing this information would mean that companies wouldn't have to start from the beginning. They could take research that's already done and perhaps move more quickly. But again, there's just this proliferation of data and information as well. And, you know, Gerald is saying we're losing lives by how long and arduous this process is.
So I'd be very interested to see the study that he's referring to. I'll look forward to reading that. And it's hard to speak in a very general way to regulations. I'd need to know which regulations in particular he's concerned about. But let me just say a couple points in response. The first is that it's very costly and burdensome for companies and for researchers and for institutions to comply with regulations. But it's important to appreciate that part of what regulations do is that they create conditions of trust for patients when they enter clinical trials, that they can be confident that their interests are going to be adequately protected. And if you don't have patients enrolling in clinical trials, you simply can never collect the information about whether a drug is safe and effective. So on the one hand, although in the short term, regulations often add a lot of cost, they create conditions, if they're effective regulations, such that patients can be confident that they're not going to harm themselves by entering into a clinical trial, that the FDA has their back, as it were. So I'm always a little bit skeptical of arguments against regulations, although clearly there are some regulations that are overly onerous or needless and other regulations that are really effective. You'd have to talk on a case-by-case basis. I want to make one other point, which is that, you know, we tend to think that there is a lot of cost associated with trying to develop a new drug. But actually, I suspect that much of the cost of testing drugs actually happens after drugs are first approved rather than before. So in a realm like cancer, typically a drug will be approved for a particular malignancy. And once it gets approved, drug companies will then sponsor trials against a variety of other kinds of malignancies in the hope that you might actually pick up, one or two new malignancies that respond to the drug. And if you look at actually the volume of clinical trials that happen before licensure, before a drug gets approved by FDA, versus after, most of the testing happens after the drug is approved and marketed. And actually, most of the burden, most of the the trials for which the drug is shown ineffective, for which there are high safety events, tend to occur after a drug is approved. So I tend to be pretty skeptical that regulations are causing lots of excess death. I actually think that's quite possible that a lot of excess death happens after drugs get approved, and drug companies, I think, get a little bit more permissive about the evidence they require in order to test that drug against other kinds of malignancies.
Although I guess the question of deaths is, you know, there's that one question of, are people dying in trials? But the other question of, an ethical question, are people dying because these drugs aren't available to them that then will be proved to be effective, which I think is specifically what Gerald was talking about in that idea of lives are being lost.
The United States has a mechanism, accelerated approval, for drugs that treat life-threatening diseases that allow a drug that is highly promising to get licensed on the basis of what I was calling earlier surrogate endpoints. So again, tumor shrinkage. So it actually can be a very, very rapid process. There was recently a cancer drug that was approved on the basis of merely a phase one clinical trial. These are very, very small clinical trials. But most cancer drugs, for example, that are approved through the accelerated pathway are approved on the basis of a phase two clinical trial. So there actually is a fairly rapid, for drugs that are highly effective and highly promising, a fairly rapid development process. And again, it's very difficult once a drug gets licensed to remove it from the market if ultimately that drug is shown to be ineffective. We've seen that again and again. So you want to maintain a pretty high bar at the point of approval, lest you approve an unsafe and ineffective drug and it get used by many, many different patients, lots of deaths and lots of gratuitous healthcare expenditures for that unsafe and ineffective drug.
We're talking about the ethics behind drug testing today with McGill University Professor Jonathan Kimmelman and hearing from some of you as well. Our number, if you'd like to weigh in or if you have a question about the ethics of drug testing, our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Michael's calling in from Pelham, New Hampshire. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Go right ahead.
So I have a question. Mostly these companies are obviously they're motivated financially to develop drugs. They're not doing it necessarily for ethical or moral reasons, and they should be bound by some ethics and morals. But I find I find that I don't know how you could argue for a company to, you know, invest millions of dollars into a development of a drug, and then when that drug fails, offer up those millions of dollars worth of research to a competitor. Wouldn't that, in effect, demotivate companies to be innovative? And wouldn't it also reward companies that weren't necessarily as competitively advantaged as the ones that are initially developing these drugs?
Michael, thanks for the question. Professor Kimmelman?
Yeah, thanks. So this gets to a point I was making earlier. So it's a pretty universally recognized ethical principle that when you expose patients to a drug in a clinical trial, that's on the expectation that you are going to produce what ethicists call generalizable knowledge, information that can be absorbed by the scientific community. And the idea is that you want to have a favorable risk-benefit balance. So when you block the process of that information getting out there into the scientific community, you are failing to redeem the sacrifice that patients will have been made. You are violating the ethical contract you've made with a patient when they've entered into the clinical trial. Let me just say one other point just to kind of make this a little bit clearer. Up until 2004, there were no requirements for drug companies to prospectively register their clinical trials in a public database. And for years, epidemiologists and others had argued that drug companies ought to do this because if you don't prospectively register, you create a risk of bias in that evidence. Drug companies resisted it. That changed in 2004, and the FDA in 2007 enacted a policy that required prospective registration. And so we went from a regime—
And by prospective registration, you mean before the trial is conducted?
Sorry, yes. So normally, before you enroll your first patient, you have to put up some of the basic information about your clinical trial in a public registry, clinicaltrials.gov. You can look it up. So we went from a regime where you had a compelling argument about why there was strategic information that was being, you know, given away into the public domain to a regime now where it's a widely, commonly accepted practice that you simply have to do that if you're going to run a clinical trial. And so, you know, what I'm describing now is really the next step, and it may seem to be pushing the drug companies hard, but it certainly looked like we were pushing the drug companies hard when we were calling for a prospective registration. And I should also add that the European Medical, or rather the EMA, which is the European equivalent of the FDA, already has mechanisms on the book that make trial information part of the public domain if they've been submitted to the agency in support of a licensing application. So what I'm describing has to some extent already been implemented in the European context.
So would somebody in the United States then be able to find information through the EMA, through the European process, that isn't necessarily made public or forced to be made public by the FDA, but is public because a drug is licensed or a drug has been trialed in somewhere in Europe?
To some extent, if the drug trial was submitted to the EMA in support of an application to get approval, the EMA will make that information available. Upon request, they also have a website. There's some very cumbersome ways in which you get access to that information, so it's not a perfect system at all, but in principle, you can. Now, if a drug company has tested a drug and not submitted it to the EMA, or if they've only tested it in, say, the U.S. setting, that the EMA can't compel that information necessarily to become public record.
So are there big differences between and among different countries in how this process is run and what governmental regulation is like?
Well, there are and there aren't. I mean, there, in terms of the process of developing a new drug and the requirements for the data that's submitted to regulatory authorities, that's fairly standardized now. There's an organization called the ICH, International Council on Harmonization, that sets forward a basic template of information that needs to be available for drug regulators when you develop a drug. But having said that, the regulatory requirements for approval vary somewhat from one jurisdiction to another. And so you occasionally have drugs that get approved in Europe, but not in the U.S., or in Canada, but not in the U.S. And you also have some differences in terms of what kind of evidence a drug regulator might require in order to get a drug approved.
Do you think that medication would cost less if there was more transparency and less redundancy in the research process, because other companies or any company would be able to know what's already been tested and failed or tested and didn't quite work? Or can companies sort of set whatever price they want, and so it may not have any difference in the actual cost to patients in the end?
One of the most expensive aspects of developing a new drug is running clinical trials, and in particular, randomized control trials. These are the large phase 3 clinical trials that you use to get a drug licensed. And it's just extremely expensive to collect very rigorous information about a drug's properties. If that information is not getting out there, other companies have to then, and for that matter, academia, public funders have to undertake substantial investments to answer a question that's already been partially answered through a clinical trial. So I think it's likely that part of the high cost of new drugs reflects the fact that we have a very inefficient system for making the information that we've collected in animal and clinical testing available to other researchers who might then build off of that.
Let's go to Robinson, who's calling in from Greensboro. Hi, Robinson. Your thoughts?
Hi. I've been running large-scale clinical trials on social programs for over 40 years, and so I've been interested in this topic from the beginning. And I've, for a couple of years, been talking about starting a journal called The File Drawer that would publish only results of failed trials. And that would remove kind of, you could get it prestigious enough, it would remove kind of some of the blockage of academics who conduct very good trials, but then nothing comes out of it, and it doesn't help them along their tenure path and so forth. And then I have a second, more radical idea I can talk about if you have a few minutes.
We don't have a few minutes, but we've got 30 seconds if you want to just give us the teaser.
Okay, and Professor Kimmel can pick up on this. That is, we really need to pursue a lot more the orphan drug model that is being used in the U.S. to encourage companies to invest in things that have very small populations for usage and so forth. And I think this could be adapted in a big way with the government taking over the clinical trials and running those in an efficient way once the drug has been gone through the molecular stage and perhaps some of the animal trials. And
yeah,
I think
Robinson, that's an interesting question because, yeah, that idea, again, of companies trying to make money, if you have a very small population that actually could use this drug, even if it's a life-saving drug, you know, where is the sort of impetus for companies to do this? What about Robinson's idea that maybe governments should take that up?
I guess I have two thoughts about that. So the first thought is, first you have to persuade Congress to allocate a sufficient enough budget for NIH to actually undertake that research. That sounds like a great plan to me. But I think that companies actually make a lot of money off of orphan drugs. It's kind of the best kept secret because typically you get an orphan drug approved, but the drug is actually used off-label for non-orphan conditions. So a really good example of this is factor 7A, which was approved for hemophilia, a very rare disorder, but that was used for the most part for treating other kinds of clotting disorders, like, for example, stroke. And so it's not clear to me that the orphan drug policies that we have are not already adequately incentivizing development of orphan drugs. They may be actually adding to increased costs of drugs. Just a quick point, if I can make, about the publication of negative results. It used to be that scientists made the argument that you can't publish negative results. There are now many prestigious venues that actually encourage researchers to submit negative or inconclusive results. One example is PLOS ONE. So you can actually build a pretty good career off of publishing a mixture of inconclusive, positive, and negative studies.
Just before we let go, you mentioned that off-label use. Now, companies are not allowed to market an off-label use that they have not gotten FDA approval for. But as you said, it's a big part of the money-making operation and the way that drugs are actually used by doctors. Would you like to see more regulation on that off-label usage and maybe more regulations on doctors as well?
I don't know about regulation on doctors. I think regulation of off-label use is an area where we could make progress. So in cancer, about 50% of prescriptions are made off-label. And although it's true, right now at least, companies can't market drugs off-label, companies can publish clinical trials that create the suggestion of efficacy and use those publications as the basis for essentially marketing in the scientific literature their drugs. And so I think we could actually make a lot more progress with responsible research in off-label conditions. It would be much better if drug companies were investing in those kinds of off-label investigations and actually filing with the FDA for approval.
Jonathan Kimmelman is an associate professor of biomedical ethics at McGill University in Montreal. Thank you very much for sharing your perspective with us.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, Vermont Yankee may not be producing power anymore. In fact, it's got a pretty hefty electric bill it now has to pay each month. But there's still a lot to be resolved about what happens next. We'll get an update from Rutland Herald reporter Susan Small here next on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Almost a year after its shutdown, the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant is still sparking debate over safety, spending, and the disposal of nuclear waste. Here with an update is Rutland Herald reporter Susan Small here. Hi, Susan. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane.
So remind us, VY shut down last December. What's actually happening at the plant right now?
The Entergy is putting a lot of the extraneous buildings into what they call safe and dark, or they're even demolishing some of the minor buildings. They're also getting ready to ultimately transfer the fuel from the spent fuel pool to a new facility that they hope to start construction next year, 2016. And that will hold the spent nuclear fuel from Vermont Yankee until the year 2052 is when Entergy is expecting the Department of Energy will take away all the spent nuclear fuel at that point.
Although there are now some questions about where that spent nuclear fuel might ultimately end up. The Texas facility that Vermont and Vermont Yankee has a contract with to take that spent fuel only has a federal permit till, I think, 2045. So is there some question now about where that might actually go?
Well, the facility in Texas is for low-level waste, and so Vermont Yankee has to be demolished and decommissioned and decontaminated before the waste can be shipped to Texas. And their permit expires in 2045, and Vermont Yankee really doesn't expect to start demolition until 2068, according to the filings that Entergy has made with the NRC.
So there are some questions then about what might happen, but that's so far down the road we just can't figure it out at this point.
I would say the facility in Texas is actually owned privately by a company called Waste Control Specialists, and it has a contract with the Texas Low-Level Radioactive Waste Disposal Compact Commission, which is actually a Texas Vermont commission. And they've been talking about expanding to take even more low-level waste. And they've also been talking about taking high-level waste, which is the spent fuel.
Susan, I want to talk about the money question, because that's perhaps the area of biggest concern for the state at this point and the biggest area of contention between the state and Entergy. The state of Vermont wants more information about how Entergy Vermont Yankee is spending the decommissioning money. Break that down for us.
Well, it's all about money, as they say. In March, which was a couple of months into decommissioning, the decommissioning trust fund was at $661 million. And now it's down to about $600 million. Yankee has made quite a few withdrawals with the so-called 30-day notice to the NRC, which is how the state of Vermont learns about it. But the state is complaining that Entergy is not giving out very much information about how it's spending the money. And Vermont has a very vested interest in not only getting the plant decommissioned as quickly as possible, because Entergy said they'll start decommissioning as long as there's the adequate funds in the decommissioning trust fund, but also whatever's left over goes back to the Vermont ratepayers who started the decommissioning trust fund to begin with back in the 60s and 70s.
So, Susan, just a minute left here, but I'm curious, is it that the state of Vermont wants Entergy to spend the money differently, or it's just worried that it doesn't actually know how the money is being spent at all and wants more transparency?
They want to, I mean, obviously they need to know how they're spending it and if they can say it's being spent wisely. There's some people are criticizing the money, I mean, the spending by Entergy, saying it's being done by a subsidiary of Entergy, and, you know, they're questioning the whole financing between Entergy and their subsidiary.
Susan Small here is a reporter with the Rutland Herald, and she's been updating us on what's been happening since Vermont Yankee Nuclear Power Plant shut down last December and the ongoing back and forth between Entergy and the state of Vermont as mediated somewhat by the NRC. Susan, thank you so much for updating us.
Certainly, Jane.
And it's time now for Listener Notes to Vermont Edition. Producer Sam Gale Rosen joins me to read some of your comments and reactions to recent programs. Sam, take it away.
On Friday, our guest was Congressman Peter Welch. We spoke with him the day after the succession plan for the Speaker of the House of Representatives fell into disarray.
There's a group here that's been empowered and emboldened, and it is on the Republican side, that feels entitled to shut the government down and default on our obligations if they don't get their way. They've got to cut the cord. That wing of the party just has to be cleaved away and not appeased.
Well, listener Pedro had this to say on that subject. Pedro says, I think the crisis of the Republican caucus is yet another symptom of the campaign funding cancer afflicting every branch of government. That group of 40 are emboldened because they know they have deep pockets behind them. The others are scared of being primaried. Is there any chance of meaningful reform? I'm listening.
And Mark posted this withering criticism. I personally found Representative Welch's appearance on Vermont Edition this past Friday to be as typically bland and wet noodle as it ever is when Representative Welch is given airtime. He's about as compelling as a bowl of plain oatmeal.
Moving on, a week ago we looked at the annual statistics released by colleges that detail the number of reported sexual assaults on campus, and we talked with representatives from a couple of local schools about what they're doing to prevent it. Deb in Shelburne wrote with this reaction. Why do I have to be afraid when I send my daughter to college? Why did I feel the need to send my daughter to a women's self-defense class before she left? Why do teenage boys and men feel it's ever okay to take advantage of a girl or a boy, be it their smaller size, their alcohol intake, or a convenient situation? Our boys need more education around the issue of respect at a much younger age, long before college and even high school. This education has to happen at home as well as in the schools. No one should be afraid for their girls. This has to stop.
We also recently looked at the Canadian federal elections. Canadians will be voting a week from today. On that program, we received this message from Nicholas. Just a note of congratulations for covering this issue. How sad that NPR doesn't seem to know that Canada exists, much less that they're having an election.
Well, we also know that today is Thanksgiving in Canada. Happy Thanksgiving, neighbors. And lastly, in our fall garden show last week, we talked with Peter Burns of Callis about how to grow salad greens indoors all winter long. He told us that he yields about 12 to 14 ounces of greens every day from his trays of sprouts. Beth was impressed. She writes, the yield on Peter's greens growing method is amazing. How wonderful to watch how fast food can be produced when there's snow outside my window in January, February, March, and April, and even May.
We love your feedback about how we're doing on Vermont Edition. Get in touch on social media or email vermontedition@vpr.net.
You can also listen back to any of the shows that you've heard here or shows that you've missed. You can podcast the program. We are on podcasts every day, so keep a listen in. And we love to hear your reactions, so please do share with us what you've heard days, weeks out. We're happy to hear from you. Sam, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. Any programs that you've produced lately that you really feel like people should listen to?
Well, there's a program coming up tomorrow on John Dewey that I think will be a big hit.
Why are you a fan of Dewey?
Dewey, I'm a big fan of the pragmatists in general. I think they're great philosophers.
Good. And I'm really looking forward to that, too, because I was under the impression that John Dewey, the native Vermonter philosopher, education reformer, was the Dewey of the Dewey Decimal System. Apparently he is not. Sam is producing that show for tomorrow, and I will be totally up to speed on it by tomorrow at noon. So I hope you can tune in, because if you, like me, thought Dewey must be Dewey Decimal, we're all wrong, and we're going to find out who this really influential Vermonter was. Dewey changed the world. So stay tuned and write in with your questions or your thoughts or your admonitions of me. You can post those notes at vpr.net by clicking on Vermont Edition, and then be sure to tune in at noon. Our producers are Sam Gale Rosen and Rick Singeri. We have production assistance from Hannah Kearns. Our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Mary Williams directed the show, and our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.